You can get a free bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label Whiskey when you subscribe to The Spectator in our Black Friday sale. Go to spectator.co.uk/Friday24.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American power, politics and prejudices. The election is over, but the Americano never stops, and there will be a lot to talk about with the second Trump administration. And so we'll bring you more and more Americano, because judging from the feedback, that's what you guys want. So please keep listening. Today, we're going to be talking about the rise of testosterone politics. And there is no greater authority on the subject than Dr. Charles Cornish Dale, a.k.a. the Roreg Nationalist, who was writing under that pseudonym, the Roreg Nationalist, until he was very rudely doxed or outed recently. Charles, I think let's just start with, because you're the person who said this phrase, testosterone politics, to me, and it struck me as particularly relevant to global politics at the moment, and particularly the re-election of Donald Trump. Just start by explaining what you mean by testosterone politics and how it's affecting world politics.
Yeah, so testosterone has become a political issue in a way that it really wasn't even a couple of years ago. So 2 years ago, I was in a documentary, a Tucker Carlson documentary called The End of Men, which focused on testosterone decline. It featured RFK Jr. in a very prominent role. And it was greeted by the liberal media with howls of derision. It was sort of denounced as a kind of semi-fascistic sort of fantasy, almost. Testosterone decline isn't happening. Testosterone decline doesn't have any kind of broader political meaning. It's code for something else. You know, Tucker Carlson, when he's talking about testosterone decline, what he's really talking about is, let's say, the declining share of white males within the American population and their loosening grip on power. So a couple of years ago, testosterone decline, although people like Tucker Carlson, people like myself, were trying to highlight the importance of testosterone decline as part of a kind of broader fertility decline, and also having, you know, the fact that it has political implications, it was considered a joke issue by the mainstream media. Anyway, fast forward 2 years to the election, and what you've got actually is testosterone as a broad sort of separating issue, I think, between the parties. So on the one hand, you had the Republicans, you had this absurd scene at the Republican National Convention where Hulk Hogan ripped his shirt off to reveal a Trump Vance T-shirt. It was like something from a 1980s action film. It was like, you know, the glory days of the World Wrestling Federation and Stallone and Schwarzenegger and all that kind of stuff. And you had J.D. Vance talking about the importance of or the differentiating factor of testosterone between Republican men and Democrat men. And then at the Democrat National Convention, you had the opposite. You had people like Dana Bash and also politicians saying, look, testosterone decline is a good thing in a sense, because what it means is that actually American men with lower testosterone are more likely to vote for a woman as a leader. It's almost like it's a necessary stage in the development, the furthering of the progressive movement, is actually sort of weaning men off testosterone so that they'll stop voting for men and that they'll choose a woman, or even indeed a woman of color, as leader. And you also had the hilarious, the bizarre spectacle of a vasectomy van being parked outside the Democrat National Convention. This may have escaped the notice of the listeners, but Planned Parenthood drove a mobile clinic to the DNC and parked it outside the convention center and offered vasectomies for any men who wanted them, and early stage abortions for women who wanted them. So there's really been a kind of coalescence around the issue of masculinity as represented by testosterone levels. And there's kind of now an agreement about the fact that, yes, testosterone is declining. Testosterone is an issue, but it's given a different valence depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on. So for the left, actually, now, testosterone decline is potentially a good thing because it's furthering progressivism, whereas on the right, of course, what we want is we want a revival of masculinity. We want men to be men again, and we want, and that means increasing testosterone levels, improving men's health, getting men to work out, all that kind of stuff.
There is a certain paradox, is there not? And I don't think this is just kind of lefty sniggering, that as testosterone decline increases, kind of machismo politics increases. Testosterone is expressing itself in the unreal sphere of politics and social media because it is in decline in real life.
I think that as the decline of testosterone becomes more obvious, then yes, you do have a kind of counter reaction. And I think for a long time, by not talking about it, then that was a deliberate strategy. And I think that the left were just sort of ignoring it because they thought that that they could get away with ignoring it. But now, of course, by talking about it, by drawing attention to it, and in fact, acknowledging that it's happening, then yes, they've helped to stimulate and give legitimacy to the counter movement. And it's something that's actually happening. It's not just happening in America, although it's perhaps happening most prominently in America. I think that we're seeing a return to a kind of stronger style of politics actually throughout the Western world. So by acknowledging it, then yes, I think in many respects, actually the left is helping us by saying the quiet part out loud, as it were, and saying that actually what these right wingers are saying is true. And it's a great help. Rather than simply being ridiculed, we're actually being confirmed, I think, in many of our presuppositions.
Well, let's start with some of the presuppositions. I mean, how real is it that testosterone is in decline?
Oh, it's very real. I mean, although you'll get mainstream media pieces, certainly over the years, saying, oh, testosterone decline isn't happening. There's very broad agreement within the scientific community that testosterone decline is happening. So there was a study called the Massachusetts Male Aging Study, which is usually abbreviated to MMAS. This was a large-scale community-based study carried out around Boston, beginning in the late 1980s and continuing into the early 2000s. Thousands of men were selected from the community. Various biomarkers were measured, including testosterone levels. And what the researchers found basically was that there was a year-on-year cumulative decline of 1% in testosterone levels over that period. So over 20 years, roughly, the average testosterone levels declined 20%. Now, that was a big shock when the MMAS was first released in sort of 2004. And I think the first analysis of the testosterone data was 2007. That study was replicated across the Western world in other countries. For instance, in Finland, they did a similar study. And the Finnish researchers thought, well, Finnish men are healthier than American men. Finnish men generally score higher on various different indices of reproductive health. So, for example, Finnish men have higher sperm counts, their sperm quality is better than American men. There are fewer instances, I think, of undescended testicles, testicular cancer, all this kind of stuff. And yet what they found as well in Finland was a similarly precipitous decline in testosterone levels, again, about 1% year on year over a long period of time, an even longer period of time. In fact, 50 plus years, I think the Finnish study looked at testosterone data. This has been reproduced in Israel. It's been reproduced around the world in various different countries. Now, there are certain problems with the measurement of testosterone. So these studies don't necessarily all follow exactly the same methodology. It's true, for example, that your testosterone levels vary throughout the day. It's true that they vary by the season. It's true that you can have an acute effect. You can have an acute kind of knock-on effect on your testosterone level if you don't sleep, for example. So you have to control for lots of different variables. And these studies don't all exactly do that, but they show basically the same thing. And actually, we have to situate this testosterone decline within a broader decline in male reproductive health. So there was a study, a book rather, that was published recently by a professor at Mount Sinai University, Shanna Swan, called Countdown. And basically the book is about the fact that perhaps within 25 years, if we extrapolate from current trends in sperm counts, men basically won't be able to reproduce by natural means. So by 2045, 2050, the median man will have a sperm count of zero based on current trends. And what that means is that half of all men will produce zero sperm, so no sperm at all, and the other half will produce so few that they might as well produce none, because they're not going to get a woman pregnant because they have so few sperm. So, you know, you would expect, if male reproductive parameters were declining to the extent that they are, sperm count, sperm quality, etc., you would expect a similar decline in testosterone levels as well. And so it falls to the critics to explain actually why there wouldn't be a decline in testosterone levels if all of these other reproductive parameters are just falling away at a frightening rate. So I think that there's very, very good evidence to suggest that, yes, there is definitely a scary decline in testosterone taking place on a societal level, on a population level, and we would expect that to have serious knock-on effects socially, economically, and politically.
I suppose the mystery is why it's happening, and there are various theories. I don't think any of them, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any of them entirely convincing, that it's a microplastics may be a factor. It may be our diet in other ways. It may be even social. It may be to do with the way that men feel in society, and psychological, therefore. What do you think?
I think it's a multifactorial problem. I don't think there's one single killer explanation for it. I think it's all sorts of things. In the longer term, if you look at human history over the last 50,000 years, then archaeologists and paleoanthropologists have suggested that there was a long-term testosterone decline associated actually with the dawn of civilization. So you can look at hunter-gatherer skeletons from, say, 50,000 years ago, and you look at their brow ridges, you look at the facial prominence and sort of skeletal markers of testosterone, and it's very clear that actually there has been a decline in kind of general robustness over a very long period of time. And some have hypothesized that maybe a decline in testosterone levels was necessary for the emergence of complex societies beyond small bands of hunter-gatherers. So there are very long-term trends, I think, taking place, and it may very well be the case that testosterone decline is associated with complex civilization, and the continuing development of industrial civilization may very well have knock-on effects at a hormonal level that are sort of necessary in order for industrial society to function properly. But there are environmental factors, as you say. You mentioned microplastics. We're just starting to understand the full scale of microplastic pollution, its ubiquity, and also some of the dreadful hormonal and metabolic effects. It's basically, microplastics are basically being linked to more or less every kind of chronic disease going at the moment. And it makes sense. In a broad way, because look, I mean, plastics have only been around basically sort of 70 years, let's say. 70 years, plastics have, over the last 70 years, plastics have become ubiquitous. And that's really when we've seen an enormous, enormous explosion in chronic disease throughout the developed world, and now in the developing world as well. But there are other factors too, lifestyle factors, obesity, diabetes. It's a complex problem. It's a very complex problem, and I don't think we'll hit on a single explanation for it. But I do think, nevertheless, that it's possible to establish that it is happening, and that it's something to do, I think, with the differences between our modern industrial lifestyle and the kind of lifestyles that humans have lived basically for the longest period of time, you know. So there's been a profound change to the way that we've lived as a result of the development of industrial civilization, the kind of foods that we eat, the way that we live more broadly, our exposure to toxic chemicals, even the way we sleep. And part of the response then to it, certainly, you know, the response that I advocate, is to return to a way of living that is more in tune actually with our evolution and with our the way that we've lived historically for the longest period of time.
Is there a point perhaps then behind that democratic argument that testosterone decline is a good thing? Because if you had a massive surge, if the opposite was happening, we had a very rapid surge in testosterone, barbaric pre-civilized behavior from men might become common.
I think first of all, what we need to understand is we need to understand that testosterone isn't just the aggression hormone, and there are all sorts of. I mean, that was the thinking for a long time, and that was certainly the early thinking about testosterone. You know, early experiments in testosterone in the late 19th century, early 20th century showed, for example, that if you castrate roosters, they stop being aggressive. You can then reaffix testicles to a rooster and it will become sort of aggressive again. And that really kind of coloured, I think, our understanding of testosterone for a long time. But actually, more recently, we've had studies, more sophisticated studies, that show that actually, you know, testosterone's important, obviously, in defining male characteristics. And one of the characteristics we tend to associate with men, of course, is increased muscle mass, increased aggression, increased size. And testosterone is responsible for those things, but it's also responsible for other things. It's also responsible for pro-social behavior. So one of my favorite studies that I love quoting all the time is this study where male macaques were given soy isoflavones. Now, soy is a very popular sort of food for vegans now, and it's hailed as a food of the future, but it's also highly estrogenic. It contains substances that mimic the female hormone estrogen and can have behavioral and physical effects. And male macaques that were fed a diet that was very rich in soy isoflavones ended up basically becoming incel monkeys. So they became passive aggressive. They sort of withdrew from the troop, and then they would be sneaky and aggressive in a kind of sort of bitchy way to their fellow macaques. And so estrogen is known, estrogen modulates aggression too. And so if you have too much estrogen, you can actually become a kind of, like I say, like a sort of passive aggressive sort of incel type. And then there are studies that show, for example, that testosterone actually will make you more honest, for example. So they do all of these laboratory-based kind of games where they'll administer people a dose of testosterone gel on the arm or a placebo, and then they'll test them with sort of game theory type scenarios. They'll get them to do sort of honesty tests and all that kind of thing. And actually, it turns out that testosterone will make men in those situations be more honest. It will make them do things like, it will make them stand up for their own beliefs in the face of the herd. It will all sorts of stuff. So it's not just the case that testosterone is the aggression hormone, certainly. But I do think that there probably is something to the argument that actually, certainly in the long term, that kind of declining testosterone may very well have been associated with the development of civilization on a long term. And it also may very well be the case that the Democrats, that the leftists are actually right. You know, if they want to create a civilization in which equality really does reign, in which they're basically all noticeable differences between men and women are erased, that actually, yes, lowering testosterone levels will be beneficial towards that end. And I think that that's actually part of the reason why. I mean, I kind of speculate about this, but the vast majority of industrial chemicals that pollute the environment, that get into the food and water, etc., are estrogenic. So they have effects, they mimic estrogen within the human body. And I often sort of speculate, well, what would it be like if actually all industrial chemicals were androgenic, if they mimic testosterone instead? And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think that if that were the case, then governments a long time ago would have taken far greater notice of the problem of industrial pollution, and they would have cleaned up the environment and the food supply. But because these chemicals are estrogenic, because they do things like, basically, they make people passive. They make people passive, they reduce the metabolic rate, they reduce kind of male assertiveness, etc. Then actually it's not such a problem to clean up the environment, because it tends in the favor, I think, of this kind of coddling, modern kind of liberal form of governance that, you know, that we see today.
Well, this is all absolutely fascinating. Let's return to the politics aspect for a bit, because if we're seeing a rise in male politicians selling themselves as very masculine, as very testosterone fueled, you know, we recently had the success of Calin Georgescu. He's just won the first round in the Romanian elections. He may not win the second, the runoff. But he is very much opposed. Reading about him reminded me of you, because he takes ice baths, he films himself on TikTok. Are we going to see more of that as men feel less testosterone in their own bodies, as men feel more of an existential threat to themselves with declining sperm counts and so on?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think there's a groundswell, I think, of support for this kind of these kind of things, like, well, just like working out, taking control of your diet, eliminating harmful food types, things like seed oils. There's a lot of talk about seed oils now, especially with the emergence of RFK and this Make America Healthy Again agenda. So, I mean, I think, yes, I have 250,000 followers on Twitter. I mean, I can tell you that there is a broad kind of groundswell, I think, of support for this kind of thing. But it will also manifest itself, yes, I think, in political movements. Now, it's probably most advanced in the US, I think. You know, you have someone like J.D. Vance, vice president. I mean, he follows me. He follows other people like me on Twitter. I mean, that's might seem like an absurdity, but it's actually not. And I mean, funnily enough, there was a Daily Telegraph article just the other day after the election about why Donald Trump is so popular with wrestlers. And there was also a couple of paragraphs about me, about how I had helped, along with this chap called Bronze Age Pervert and some other accounts, to kind of mobilize an army of right-wing bodybuilders to kind of represent Trump. Yeah, there's definitely a recognition too, I think. You know, if newspapers are taking this seriously overseas, then I think it's very clear that actually there is something coalescing. And yes, I mean, as an alternative to the kind of stifling, almost gynocratic state of liberal politics throughout the Western world, then I think people will be looking for strong male leaders, and for ways to assert themselves, men certainly, to assert themselves, to assert their masculinity, to regain it. And, you know, I think that exercise, that fitness, is going to become actually much more political than it's probably ever been. And that's simply a function, I think, of the recognition that actually we are so unhealthy, but also that actually being unhealthy has big political implications.
Well, there's a lot of talk in the run-up to the American election about this being the gender election, people called it, and men pitching themselves against women, women against men, and so on. But that's a little bit simplistic, isn't it, to look at in those ways? Because, I mean, for instance, how do you think women think about the issue of testosterone? I mean, one can't make broad assumptions, but that's an important factor in the way it affects politics.
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of the I often get accused of being a sort of masculinist and all that kind of stuff. But actually, another M words. But you know, I often emphasise, look, the end of men. That was the, you know, the title of the Tucker Carlson documentary. The end of men, in a very real sense, is the end of women as well. Many of the causes of masculine decline, of testosterone decline, of male reproductive decline are also affecting women too in a very real way. So exposure to harmful endocrine, that's hormone disrupting chemicals, takes a terrible toll on women too. So there was a study, for example, that showed recently, I think it was out of Singapore, that showed that women who are exposed to a class of chemicals called PFAS, they're per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, flame retardants, greaseproof paper, nonstick coatings, that's PFAS. Women exposed to those chemicals in higher concentrations during pregnancy have up to a 40% less chance of bringing a live baby to full term. So this actually isn't the issue of male decline, male reproductive decline, isn't something that you can actually separate neatly from the issue of female health and female reproductive health. So that's important. It's important to emphasize that. And I do try to emphasize that, that actually this is basically a species-wide problem now. But on the sort of broader point of masculinity and femininity, I mean, they're complementary and they should be. And I think that people are reacting quite strongly now, men and women, to the absurd notion that there is absolutely no difference between men and women. You know, this animates, for example, the transgender issue. You know, I mean, it's women who are speaking out against the excesses of the left, especially with regard to gender politics, because actually what they're realizing is that, you know, the left is erasing the meaningful differences between men and women, and it has a terrible effect on women. It makes women less safe. All of the hard-won freedoms that women have accrued over the last century are disappearing. You know, we could very conceivably see a day in the not too distant future when actually women's sport is dominated by men, is dominated by biological men. And so actually, I think the excesses of the left are forcing reasonable people, men and women, to think very carefully and to acknowledge the realities of biology, of gender differences, and actually how maintaining them is central to maintaining civilization as we know it and as it has existed, you know, for the longest period of time. So I don't think actually that there's a way to pitch this that isn't misogynistic, that doesn't alienate women, and actually says, look, the differences between the genders, the differences between men and women are necessary, they're ineradicable, and what we actually need to do is we need to encourage them, their full expression. We shouldn't suppress them if we actually want to have a productive, functioning society. So I think that there's every reason to believe that actually this is an issue that women can get behind too.
If Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the kind of great hope for testosterone revival in America, perhaps, that would involve a huge political, economic battle against agribusiness, against big pharma, because the two things are connected, are they not? I mean, big pharma profits a lot from the fact that a lot of children, we think, are being made sick by the food they eat. It's essentially going to war with the most powerful economic parts of the global economy.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I mean, I'm under no illusion that RFK Jr. faces an enormous, enormous uphill battle. I mean, it's certain, you know, even if he were able to implement his entire agenda perfectly over the next 4 years, he wouldn't make America healthy again. I mean, the certainly not within 4 years. You know, I mean, you have to understand that, look, these problems have been accruing for 70 years at least. You know, we're talking about it's taken decades and decades for America to get to the point where 75% of the population is overweight or obese. And then you have to add in, yes, you have to add in the very sort of powerful fact that he is going against these enormous corporate, industrial, and governmental interests too. So, you know, I mean, he's a great critic of the revolving door culture between, for example, the FDA and industry. So regulators who work for the FDA, who regulate food additives and drugs, go on to work for the companies they've been regulating. And there was a big scandal, or a minor scandal, I suppose, as a result of the authorization of the coronavirus vaccines, when regulators from the FDA then went to work for Moderna, Pfizer, etc. I mean, so there's an entrenched culture of corruption, and it is corruption. You know, these organizations were not, like the FDA, the EPA, the USDA, weren't supposed to work like this. They were supposed to work in the interests of the American people, to protect the American people and to prevent corporations from introducing substances and products into the food supply, into the pharmaceutical supply that were actually harmful. So we're talking billions of dollars. We're talking massive lobbying groups that have huge power in Washington. We're talking American jobs too, to a certain degree, you know, because we would have, I mean, RFK would have to, we'll really have to overhaul the US farming system as well, because part of the reason why the food supply is the way that it is, why it's so full of things like high fructose corn syrup and cheap soy and all of these other cheap ingredients, is because of a subsidy system that's been in place, you know, for decades that rewards overproduction of corn and now soy. And these, you know, massive farms are controlled by corporate interests. So there's this whole really, really complicated tangle that he needs to pick apart and rearrange. And he can expect to be fought tooth and claw by some of the most powerful economic and political interests in the US, and he's already facing a lot of pushback. You know, he hasn't even been confirmed yet as head of Health and Human Services, and there are already people within the Republican Party trying to get rid of him, people who have, or to prevent him from being confirmed, people who have, let's say, ties to big pharma, to agribusiness, etc. So, yeah, I wouldn't underestimate the scale or the severity, the ferocity of the fight back that he's going to face, because it's going to be really, really hard.
To what extent, and I don't mean to be too gloomy, to what extent do you think testosterone politics is just in itself raging against a civilization that's inevitably collapsing, and we're seeing the signs of it?
Yeah, I mean, in my sort of slightly darker moments, and I do wonder whether actually what we're seeing is something that we can't really fight, whether there is just an inevitable aspect to testosterone decline. And that may very well be the case. And in fact, actually, that's something that I'm arguing in my new book. So I'm writing a book called The Last Men, Liberalism and the Death of Masculinity. And it's following on from the themes of the Tucker Carlson documentary about testosterone decline, masculine decline, but sort of looking at it through the lens of Francis Fukuyama's end of history thesis. So people forget, for example, about Francis Fukuyama, that actually, I mean, he's presented as this kind of champion of liberalism, and the end of history is this sort of paean to the triumph of liberal democracy over communism. And he's kind of become the straw man that he was sort of portrayed as. But actually, the final third of the book, or final quarter of the book, is that this kind of devastating Nietzschean critique of liberal democracy, where he says, look, like, okay, liberal democracy is this kind of end stage of history. we're not going to get a better political system than this. But actually, liberal democracy cannot satisfy man's innermost desire for distinction, something that the Greeks call thymos, which is a part of this, is part of your soul, basically, that, that seeks distinction, that seeks to assert oneself, to kind of basically to assert yourself and kind of triumph over your fellow man, to assert yourself over your peers and gain distinction and laurels, etc. Well, Fukuyama says, look, you know, liberal democracy by its very nature doesn't actually allow men to do that. It, all it offers you actually is it offers you the ability to be equal. And that isn't, I mean, some men are satisfied with that. Some men will be satisfied with a kind of passive life of consumerism where they simply, you know, work and buy stuff and you've got Netflix and you've got DoorDash and Just Eat and all that, that kind of stuff. But actually for other men, liberal democracy in its very kind of, by its very nature, just can't satisfy this kind of inner yearning to be better, actually, to be better than other men. And so, I mean, Fukuyama's very gloomy prognostication is that actually what we will see in the future is, he calls them immense wars of the spirit. He says there will be immense wars of the spirit when men essentially revolt against the kind of herd-like, cattle-like existence of the majority of people under liberal democracy. And I think that we've actually seen aspects of that since Fukuyama published his book. So he published it in, I think, 1991. The original essay was 1989, that then became the book. We've seen it with things like, for example, Islamic State, you know, this kind of, and other radical Islamic movements in the Middle East and elsewhere, where actually you've got this really, really visceral, violent reaction against the spread of liberalism, against the spread of liberal democracy. And so, you know, the kind of Fukuyama thing is that basically maybe that's the maybe that's the only way that men will ever satisfy this kind of desire, this thymos. So, I mean, I agree with that on a fundamental level. I do think that actually the political system, by its very nature, is frustrating for men, and it's becoming more frustrating. And I think, I don't think that there are any easy answers. I think that we can improve our health, and I think that, that we can reverse testosterone decline to an extent. We can reverse male reproductive decline and health decline more broadly, but we're still left in this quite, we're still in this kind of cleft stick. We're still in this kind of catch-22 situation where actually, nevertheless, even if we're, our health is all right, then there's still something fundamental about the political system that actually is inimical to a key aspect, I think, of masculinity, of masculine existence. And whether we can solve that within within the boundaries of liberal democracy, I think is a moot point, actually.
And that point about spirit, or you know, Fukuyama sort of described it, sort of spiritual boredom almost creates conflict. That points towards something that the Islamic State in its way points towards, which is the decline of religion and then its reemergence in other peculiar ways. And of course, for Western civilization, that points towards the decline of Christianity. And I think what's interesting about the testosterone politics you're talking about is it's often linked to Christianity and a kind of pining for the Christian world that seems to have gone.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you certainly, within the broader ecosystem within which I exist online, then yes, you get a lot of, you get this sort of style of posting that's called return to tradition. And it's, you know, it's people talking about the glories of the Christian Middle Ages, trad wives, all this kind of stuff. You know, there's definitely lots of C.S. Lewis quotes, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, there's definitely, I think there's definitely an explicitly religious, there's definitely an explicitly religious element to all of this that's brought out more by some people than others. I mean, you get others, you get people like Bronze Age Pervert, for example, who really is talking about returning to pre-Christian notions of masculinity, to kind of Hellenic virtue and ancient Roman virtue before Christianity. I mean, it's a common trope, you know, that certainly going back to Gibbon and probably before Gibbon, that, you know, the Christianization of the Roman Empire was, in a sense, its downfall. It made the Roman Empire, for want of a better word, kind of effeminate. The Roman Empire lost its hard edge. It kind of turned against itself in certain kind of life-denying aspects, perhaps, in Nietzsche as well. And Nietzsche is a big influence on Bronze Age perverts. So there's an ambivalence, I think, about the religious response actually to masculinity, because on the one hand, you'll have a lot of people who say, well, you know, what we need is we need a virtuous Christian society again. We need, you know, sort of men to be patriarchs in the Christian sense and women to be trad wives. But then you also have these other people who say, look, no, actually, Christianity itself is the problem. And there's been actually a long decline in Western civilization as a result of Christianity. And what we need to do is we need to go back to the pagan roots. We need to go back to Greek and Roman civilization. So I think it's more complicated actually in the West than it might be, for instance, in the Middle East. I think that the self-assertive kind of warlike aspects of Islam obviously come to the fore much more easily than the kind of warrior aspects of Christianity, for example. You know, I mean, it's Christianity, in a sense, people like the conquistadors who are often held up as examples of a kind of muscular Christianity, of an assertive masculine Christianity. Well, you know, you can very easily argue that actually they weren't really Christian at all, and that, you know, what they were was they were kind of like an embodiment of the kind of a more deeper element within Christianity that was brought into Christianity by the barbarian invasions, by the kind of Christian accommodation with barbarian Germanic groups, that element has been kind of weeded out of Christianity, and you can't kind of get it back. It's complicated, I think. It's complicated, and I don't think that that Christianity offers an unambiguous example for a masculine revival, because, of course, yes, you have these figures like the conquistadors, yes, you have David, etc., but you also have the long-standing Christian ideal of asceticism, of mortification of the body, of a kind of contempt for the body, contempt for bodily functions, etc., of looking to the next world, beyond the kind of weakness of the flesh. The image, the central image of Christianity, is God nailed to a cross. And that's it's an image of triumph. Of course it's an image of triumph, but it's not an unambiguous bodily vision of triumph in the way that, for instance, you know, a beautiful Hellenic statue of the Farnese Hercules, for example, is.
Well, I know people reach for Hitler far too quickly, and I'm sorry to do this, but the yearning for a kind of pre-Christian manliness and sort of esoteric ideas, pagan spiritual ideas, the attraction of that, and the sort of repulsion that you see in some quarters towards Christianity is precisely what drove fascism, is it not?
Yeah, and look, I mean, that is a recurrent criticism. That was a criticism of the Tucker Carlson documentary. So, you know, they said, this imagery of, so we had a group of men working out, you know, a group of right-wing bodybuilders, including myself, working out on Alex Jones's ranch. And, you know, this is fascistic because it's organized exercise, glorification, physical glorification of the body, all that kind of stuff. Yes, I mean, you know, people will say, oh, well, this is Lena Riefenstahl, this is Triumph of the Will, this is the Berlin Olympics, this is Arno Brecker sculptures, you know, this is glorification of the body rather than glorification of God, whatever you want to say, you know, it's like a proxy or a substitute for it. I mean, yes, it's undeniable that that fascism definitely does glorify the body, did glorify the body. But whether or not it inevitably makes a kind of new cult of the body or a new focus on the body, fascistic, I think is a moot point. I mean, and part of the problem today, of course, with the label fascist Nazi is that it's bandied about so much that it's actually emptied of all its content. And so, I mean, inevitably, you know, when people hear it, they just either sort of agree with it or they roll their eyes. But certainly, I mean, I don't think that the Donald Trump project, the RFK project to make America healthy again, is fascistic. And in fact, actually, this is a point. So The End of Men, the documentary that I was in, then the documentary makers gave a very, very prominent place to John F. Kennedy. So John F. Kennedy gave a speech. I think it was kind of like a lost speech that was kind of found in the archives, where he talked about the health of the nation, about the importance of the health of the nation. He said something very funny about, you know, how every parent would be embarrassed to have a chubby little child, all that kind of stuff. And John F. Kennedy actually wanted to lead a national physical revival. So he was very, very enamored with this high school in California called La Sierra. And La Sierra had this high school fitness program for young men that was like a kind of military boot camp type thing, where you would do assault courses and you would have goals for number of push-ups you could do and chin-ups and all that kind of stuff. It's like a regimented physical fitness course. And John F. Kennedy wanted to implement that across America in every single high school. But what's interesting about this, of course, is that John F. Kennedy is the archetypal modern Democrat president. You know, I mean, John F. Kennedy is a hero to the Democrat Party. And yet here he is in this documentary saying exactly the same things about the importance of physical health to the nation, the importance of, you know, not allowing young people to be obese and inactive. Here he is saying exactly the same things as a group of dangerous right-wing bodybuilders, you know, on Twitter. So, that was deliberately intended, actually, I think, to scramble the minds of leftist critics. And it was noticeable, actually, that they just totally ignored the fact that John F. Kennedy was saying exactly the same things as I'm saying, or as any of, you know, my peers on Twitter are saying. So I think, yeah, you obviously have to recognize that the glorification of the body was a part of fascism. Of course it was. Nobody can deny that. But whether a new kind of cult of the body has to be fascistic is at the very least moot. And I mean, I would personally disagree with that point and say, look, I think that it doesn't have to be, can be, but it doesn't have to be. And I think that the presence of RFK Jr., who again, I mean, he's a lifelong Democrat. You know, he's not a secret right-wing figure. I mean, he is a lifelong Democrat, but he keeps himself in great shape. And, you know, he believes that the health of the nation is a very, very important thing. And I think that if he's successful with this Make America Healthy Again movement, then I think that it could very well become the kind of unifying issue, actually, that I think it should be, that I think health should be. I don't think it should be a partisan issue, although it is a partisan issue now. I actually think it has the potential to bring people together from both sides of the political spectrum. But whether or not it will do that, I don't know.
And of course, he is the nephew of JFK, so it comes full circle. One more question, Charles. Perhaps the kind of desperation to put fascism, to apply the label fascist, is a mistake, because what might be going on is we are coming full circle. Ferdinand Mount wrote a book called Full Circle, all about the way we are returning to Roman habits, to Roman behaviours, to a Roman society. And we have Gladiator 2 is out in the cinemas, and people have made this point. I think Ridley Scott is hinting at the point in the film that there are Roman aspects to Trumpism.
Yes, yeah, I mean, there are. Well, one of the one of the interesting things about the Trump phenomenon is the way that Trump is portrayed as Caesar. And I mean, I've written about this in the context of people, basically prominent people within the US political establishment, people like Robert Kagan, the husband of Victoria Nuland, have basically tried to legitimize violence against Trump. You know, so they've portrayed Trump as America's Caesar. And we all know what happened to Caesar, right? We all know about the knives on the Senate floor, about the conspiracy. Every schoolboy knows about that, or did know about that. So, I mean, the kind of the Caesar analogy is interesting. The kind of Trumpism as Caesarism thing is interesting because it's used, first of all, as a way of labeling Donald Trump as a uniquely dangerous figure to the American Republic, because, of course, Caesar brought an end to the Roman Republic after however many hundred years. And now they're saying, look, you know, Donald Trump is going to cross the Rubicon. He is going to become a dictator. He's going to become a tyrant. And maybe what we need is we need a contemporary Brutus to do something about that, or contemporary conspiracy of prominent people to do something about that. And there was, of course, that play. I remember there was a staging of Julius Caesar in the US where Caesar was Donald Trump and he was, you know, murdered, which is pretty, you know, pretty clear cut what they're trying to say. But the broader kind of I think the broader analogy, once you get beyond the once you get beyond the specifics, the specific allusion to Caesar himself, I don't really know how. I mean, you can see that Trump, like, for instance, when Trump turned up at the UFC recently, and when John Jones was fighting, and I mean, he was given a hero's welcome at Madison Square Garden. I mean, rapturous applause, and, you know, he did the Trump dance, and then John Jones did the Trump dance when he won, and then he jumped over and handed his belt to Donald Trump. I mean, there's obviously something, there's a charismatic element to the Trump phenomenon that obviously leads to discussion about Trump as a kind of king-like figure, I think, or an emperor-like figure, or a tyrant even. But actually, I mean, it kind of dissolves when you look at Donald Trump's policies, when you get beyond the hyperbole about Donald Trump himself, the figure, the charismatic allure, the way that he does politics, the very personal way that he does politics, where he goes to the people, he holds these huge rallies where he sort of, you know, has the audience in rapt attention. And obviously, you know, the assassination attempt as well. I mean, that was an incredible spectacle, and that was definitely not out of the modern political playbook. I mean, I can't imagine very many other politicians standing on stage in the line of fire and making this dramatic gesture, you know, fight, fight, fight. I mean, that was like something that you would have seen in another age rather than the modern democratic age.
That's the purest expression of testosterone politics we couldn't think of.
Yeah, I mean, it really was, and it won a lot of people over. But actually, when you look at Donald Trump's policies more broadly, then actually he's basically like a 90s Democrat in many respects. I mean, you know, you can go on YouTube and you can find videos of pretty much every politician back to Bill Clinton saying that they should build a border wall with Mexico. I mean, so it's not... It's a funny mixture. Obviously, Donald Trump has this personal charisma that makes him a figure of loyalty and allegiance beyond party. And he's obviously, you know, I mean, he's transforming the Republican Party and building this broader kind of MAGA movement, populist movement that is united behind him as a person rather than a party. So there's definitely that. But actually, there are very, very powerful reasons, very obvious reasons to see that Trump is not America's Caesar. I mean, I think there may very well in the future be a Caesar type figure in the US, but I don't know that it's actually Trump. I think Trump may prefigure that kind of figure, but it's going to be someone else who is much more explicitly anti-democratic than Trump is.
And I suppose if we are returning to a Roman Republic, perhaps we should be grateful that testosterone levels are slightly lower for all of our health and safety.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, I think we need to ease ourselves in a little bit to existence in a kind of restored Roman Republic. Yes.
Well, on that note, Charles, thank you very much for coming on to the Americano show. I feel I should go and do a workout.
It was my pleasure. And yeah, I will be working out very shortly. And so, yes, maybe you should too.
Thank you. Thank you very much for listening to that episode of the Americano show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows. Thanks again for listening. All the best.